They must not have wanted me to know. Come on, the detective said. You're lying. Over and over they mocked her about the disparity. The boys told Zach about the pipe bombs, but they never told her. No, no, never. That's what they were like. When they wanted you to know something, you knew. When they wanted you in the dark, you stayed there. They could get very secluded about it, very isolated. They'd kept on her. The guns were an isolated incident, she said. And Zach, he didn't know much either. He knew they were making bombs, but he had no idea what they were up to. The interrogation went on for hours. Robin held her ground. Bomb squads had been through the school several times and found nearly 100 bombs of varying sizes and composition. Most exploded, some not. Most were pipe bombs or crickets, but one in the cafeteria stood out. A big white propane tank standing upright, nearly 2 feet tall. It was wedged against a 1 gallon gasoline can. The most ominous part was the alarm clock. There were remnants of an orange duffel bag, too, mostly burned away. The car bombs were also discovered, with more faulty wiring. The diversionary bomb in the field was disturbing for another reason. It had blown shortly after being moved, suggesting booby traps. Tripwires could be anywhere. The FBI provided a group of crime scene specialists to assist in the massive effort of documenting the evidence. At 8:15 on Thursday morning, the team slogged through the cafeteria debris. Hundreds of backpacks, lunch trays, and half-eaten meals had been abandoned, many of them knocked over, singed by fire, or scattered by explosions, and everything had been soaked by the sprinkler system, which had run for hours. Muted pagers buried inside the backpacks beeped methodically, alerting the kids to phone home. As they walked, an agent spotted a blue duffel bag 10 feet from the burned-out orange bag with the big bomb. It was bulging and sized to fit the same contraption. They walked over. One of the agents pressed slowly on the top, hard. Probably another tank. They called help over, a couple of deputies and an FBI bomb technician. One of the officers was Mike Guerra, the same man who had investigated Eric Harris a year earlier. He sliced open the bag. They could see the end of a propane tank and an alarm clock that matched the other. There were still active bombs in here. How many more? They closed off the area immediately. Had the propane bombs detonated, they would have incinerated most or all of the inhabitants of the commons. They would have killed 500 people in the first few seconds. 4 times the toll in Oklahoma City. More than the 10 worst domestic terrorist attacks in U.S. history combined. For investigators, the big bombs changed everything. The scale, the method, and the motive of the attack. Above all, it had been indiscriminate. Everyone was supposed to die. Columbine was fundamentally different from the other school shootings. It had not really been intended as a shooting at all. Primarily, it had been a bombing that failed. That same day, officials announced the discovery of the big bombs and their destructive power. It instigated a new media shockwave, but curiously, journalists failed to grasp the implications. Detectives let go of the targeting theory immediately. It had been sketchy to begin with, and now it was completely disproved. The media never shook it off. They saw what happened at Columbine as a shooting and the killers as outcasts targeting jocks. They filtered every new development through that lens. 23. Gifted Boy. Dylan Bennett Klebold was born brilliant. He started school a year early, and by third grade was enrolled in the CHIPS program, challenging high intellectual potential students. Even among the brains, Dylan stood out as a math prodigy. The early start didn't impede him intellectually, but strained his shyness further. The idealistic Klebolds named their 2 boys after Dylan Thomas and Lord Byron. Tom and Sue met at Ohio State University, studying art. Tom in sculpture. They moved to Wisconsin and earned more practical masters, Tom in geophysics, Sue in education, as a reading specialist. Tom took an oil job and moved the family to Jeffco before the Denver Metroplex stretched out to reach them. Dylan was born there, 5 months after Eric, September 11, 1981. Both grew up as small-town boys. Dylan earned merit badges in the Cub Scouts and won a Pinewood Derby contest. Sports were always big. He was a driven competitor, hated to lose. When he pitched in Little League, he liked to whiff hitters so badly they tossed their bats. He would idolize major leaguers until the day he died. The Klebold house was orderly and intellectual. Sue Klebold was a stickler for cleanliness, but Dylan enjoyed getting dirty. A neighbor, the woman who would struggle so hard to stop Eric before the massacre, fed Dylan's early Huck Finn appetite. Judy Brown was the neighborhood mom, serving up treats, hosting sleepovers, and rounding up the boys for little adventures. Dylan had met her son Brooks in the gifted program. Brooks had a long, egg-shaped face, like Dylan's, narrowing at the jaw. But where Dylan's eyes were animated, Brooks's drooped, leaving a perpetual, weary, worried expression. Both boys grew faster than their classmates. Brooks would eventually reach 6'5". They would hang out all afternoon at the Browns' house, munching Oreos on the sofa, asking Judy politely for another. Dylan was painfully shy with strangers, but he would run right up, plop down in her lap, and snuggle in there. He couldn't be more adorable, until you tripped his fragile ego. It didn't take much. Judy first saw him blow when he was 8 or 9. They had driven down to a creek bed for a typical adventure. Sue Klebold had come along, horrified by all the mud, but bearing it to bond with her boy. Officially, it was a crawdad hunt, but they were always on the lookout for frogs or tadpoles or anything that might slither by. Sue fretted about bacteria, hectoring the boys to behave and keep clean. They'd brought a big bucket to haul the crawdads home, but came back up the hillside with nothing to show. Then one of the boys slogged out of the creek with a leech attached to his leg. The kids all went delirious. They plopped the leech into the frog jar, a mayonnaise bottle with holes punched in the lid, and watched it incessantly. They had a picnic lunch and then ran back for more fun in the creek. The water was only a foot deep, but too murky for them to see the bottom. Dylan's tennis shoes squished down into the glop. All the boys were slipping around, but Dylan took a nastier slide. He wheeled his arms wildly to catch himself, lost the battle, and smacked down on his butt. His shorts were soaked instantly. Dank black water splashed his clean t-shirt. Brooks and his brother Aaron howled. Dylan went ballistic. "Stop!" he screamed. "Stop laughing at me! Stop! Stop!" The laughing ended abruptly. Brooks and Aaron were a little alarmed. They had never seen a kid freak out like that. Judy rushed over to comfort Dylan, but he was inconsolable. Everybody was silent now, but Dylan kept screaming for them to stop. Sue grabbed him by the wrist and whisked him away. It took her several minutes to calm him down. Sue Klebold had come to expect the outbursts. Over time, Judy did too. "I would see Dylan get frustrated with himself and go crazy," she said. He would be docile for days or months. Then the pain would boil over, and some minor transgression would humiliate him. Judy figured he would grow out of it, but he never did. Detectives assembled portraits of the killers that felt maddeningly similar and vanilla. Youngest sons of comfortable, two-parent, two-child, quiet, small-town families. The Klebolds had more money. The Harrises were more mobile. Each boy grew up in the shadow of a single older sibling, a bigger, taller, stronger brother. Eric and Dylan would eventually share the same hobbies, classes, job, friends, clothing choices, and clubs. But they had remarkably different interior lives. Dylan always saw himself as inferior. The anger and the loathing traveled inward. He was taking it out on himself, Judy Brown said. Dylan's mother was Jewish. Sue Klebold had been born Sue Yasinoff, part of the prominent Jewish family in Columbus. Her paternal grandfather, Leo Yasinoff, was a philanthropist and a bit of a local tycoon. The city's Leo Yasinoff Jewish Community Center was established by the foundation he funded. Classmates said Dylan had never shared Eric's fascination with Hitler, Nazis, or Germany, and some suggested it bothered him. Tom was Lutheran, and the family practiced some of each religion. They celebrated Easter and Passover with a traditional Seder. Most of the year, they remained quietly spiritual, without much organized religion. In the mid-1990s, they took a stab at a traditional church. They joined the parish of St. Philip Lutheran Church. The boys went to services along with their parents. Their pastor, Reverend Don Markshausen, described them as hardworking, very intelligent, 60s kind of people. They don't believe in violence or guns or racism, and certainly aren't anti-Semitic. They liked Markshausen, but formal church service just wasn't a good fit for them. They attended for a brief time and then dropped away. Sue spent her career in higher education. She began as a tutor, then a lab assistant, and finally worked with disabled students. In 1997, she left the local community college for a position with the Colorado Community College System. She coordinated a program there to help vocational rehab students get jobs and training. Tom did reasonably well in the oil business, but better at renovating and renting out apartments. He was great with repairs and remodeling. A hobby became a business. Tom and Sue formed Fountain Real Estate Management to buy and administer the properties. Tom continued consulting to independent oil companies part-time. The Klebolds were rising financially, but worried about spoiling their kids. Ethics were central in their household, and the boys needed to learn restraint. Tom and Sue settled on appropriate figures to spend on the boys and stuck to them. One Christmas, Dylan wanted an expensive baseball card that would have consumed his entire gift budget. Sue was torn. One tiny present in addition to the card for her boy? Maybe she could spend a little extra. Nope. Austerity was a gift, too, and Dylan got what he asked for, and no more. In 1990, as Metro Denver encroached into Jeffco, the Klebolds retreated beyond the Hogback, the first strip of foothills hundreds of feet high, which from the air looked like the bumps along a hog's back. The Hogback functions like Denver's coastline. It feels like civilization ends there. Roads are scarce, homes are distant and highly exclusive. Shops and commerce and activity are almost non-existent. The family moved into a run-down glass and cedar house on Deer Creek Mesa, inside a panoramic rock formation, a smaller version of the Red Rocks Amphitheater a few miles away. Tom gradually brought the house back into stunning shape. Dylan officially lived in the backcountry now, part-time country boy riding over to the populated side every morning for school in suburbia. In seventh grade, Dylan faced a frightening transition. He had been sheltered among the brainiacs in CHIPS. Ken Carroll Middle School was five times as big, and it didn't have a gifted program. Tom described Dylan lurching from cradle to reality. 24. Hour of Need. Reverend Markshausen led a congregation of several thousand at St. Philip Lutheran Church. Quite a few attended Columbine. He spent much of the hostage crisis at Leawood, searching for students, calming parents. His parish appeared to be spared. He organized a vigil that first evening at St. Philip. He distributed communion, a task he found utterly soothing. The gently whispered interplay calmed him like a mantra. The body of Christ. Amen. The body of Christ. Amen. It was a steady cadence, his softly commanding baritone punctuated by a brief, nearly inaudible response. A fluttering variety of tenors and sopranos colored his symphony, but the rhythm remained the same. As the communion line dwindled, a woman softly broke the spell. The body of Christ, he said. Klebold. What? It startled him at first. But this happened occasionally. A parishioner lost herself in prayer on the slow march up the aisle, and the pastor's voice startled her out of it. Reverend Markshausen tried again. The body of Christ. Klebold. This time, he recognized the word from the TV. He had forgotten his brief association with the family. He looked up. The woman continued. Don't forget them in their hour of need. She accepted the host and moved on. That night, Marxhausen checked the parish rolls. Tom and Sue Klebold and their two boys, Dylan and Byron, had registered 5 years ago. They had not stayed long, but that did not diminish his responsibility. If they had failed to find a spiritual home, they remained under his care. He found a family close to Tom and Sue and sent word that he was available. They called a few days later. "I need your help," Tom said. That was obvious. His voice was shaking. He needed a funeral for his boy. How embarrassing to ask after a 5-year absence, but Tom was out of options. He also had a requirement. "It has to be confidential," he said. "Of course," Marxhausen said, "to both counts." He talked to Tom and then Sue, asked how they were doing. "They used the word devastated," he recalled later. "I didn't want to ask them any more." Tom and Sue received the body on Thursday. The service was conducted on Saturday. It was done quietly, with just 15 people, including friends, family, and clergy. Marxhausen brought another minister and both their wives. Dylan lay in an open casket, his face restored, no sign of the gaping head wound. He looked peaceful. His face was surrounded by a circle of Beanie Babies and other stuffed toys. When Marxhausen arrived, Tom was in denial. Sue was falling apart. She crumpled into the pastor's arms. Marxhausen engulfed her. Her frail body quaked. She sobbed there for perhaps a minute and a half, which is a long time, he said. Tom just couldn't see his little boy as that killer. "This was not my son," is how Marxhausen paraphrased his statements the next day. "What you see in the papers was not my son." The other mourners arrived, and the awkwardness only increased. A liturgy wasn't going to help them. Marxhausen felt a terrible need to scrap his service and let them speak. "Do you mind if we just talk for a while?" he suggested, "and then we'll worship." He shut the door and asked who wanted to begin. "There was this one couple. They just poured out their hearts," he recalled. "Their son used to play with Dylan when the boys were little. They loved Dylan." "Where did the guns come from?" Tom asked. "They had never had more than a BB gun. Where did the violence come from? What was this Nazi stuff?" "And the anti-Semitism," Sue said. She's Jewish. Dylan was half-Jewish. "What kind of sense did this make?" "They were such good parents," a friend said. "Dylan was a great kid. He was like our son." They went around and around, fewer than a dozen of them, but for 45 minutes they spilled out anguish and confusion and love for the awkward kid who'd had occasional outbursts. Dylan's brother Byron mostly listened. He sat quietly between Tom and Sue and finally spoke up near the end. "I want to thank you all for being here today, for my parents and myself," he said. "I love my brother." Then Marxhausen read from Scripture and offered some muted encouragement. "True enough, there will be those who do not know grace and will want to give only judgment," he said. "But help would come in time and in surprising ways. I have no idea how you are going to heal, but God still wants to reach out to you and will always reach out to you in some way." He read the Old Testament story of Absalom, beloved son of King David. Absalom skillfully ingratiated himself to his father, the court, and all the kingdom, but secretly plotted to seize the throne. Eventually, he thrust Israel into civil war. He appeared poised to vanquish his father, but David's generals prevailed. The king was informed first of the triumph, then of his son's death. David's grief made the victory like a defeat, and the people stole silently into the city. Marxhausen read from 2 Samuel. David wept and cried out, "Oh, my son, Absalom, my son Absalom! Would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son!" The Klebolds were afraid to bury Dylan. His grave would be defaced. It would become an anti-shrine. They cremated his body and kept the ashes in the house. Markshausen assumed the media would get wind of the service. He asked one of the Klebold attorneys how to handle the inquiries. The attorney said, "Just tell them what you've seen here tonight." So he did. He told the New York Times, which featured the account on the front page. Tom and Sue were racked by grief, guilt, and utter confusion, he said. They lost their son, but their son was also a killer. He told the story lovingly. He described Tom and Sue as the loneliest people on the planet. Don Markshausen made some of his parish exceptionally proud. That was their pastor, a man who could find compassion in his heart for anyone, a man capable of consoling the couple who had unwittingly produced a monster. That's why they had packed the pews to hear him every Sunday. Some of his parish, and much of the community, was appalled. Lonely? The Klebolds were lonely? Several of the victims were still awaiting burial. Survivors still faced surgery. It would be months before some would walk again, or talk again, or discover they never would. Some people had trouble rousing sympathy for the Klebolds. Their loneliness was not an especially popular concern. Wayne and Kathy Harris presumably held some ceremony for Eric, but they have never once spoken to the press. Word never leaked.
This audiobook is continued on Disc 5. Columbine by Dave Cullen. Continued. Disc 5.
25. Threesome. No one remembers for sure how Eric and Dylan met. Eric arrived at Ken Carroll Middle School in 7th grade. Dylan was already attending. The two boys met there at some point, but didn't connect right away. They both continued on to Columbine High. Brooks Brown re-entered the school district there. His friendship with Dylan had fallen off after his parents moved him into private schools years earlier. But he returned to public school his freshman year and met Eric on the bus. Pretty soon, all three were tight. They played video games for hours. Sometimes they played in person, but they also stayed up late competing online. They went to Columbine Rebel football games together freshman year. Eric was practically a celebrity because his brother was a starter on the varsity team. Eric, Brooks, and Dylan were three aspiring intellectuals. They took an interest in classical philosophers and Renaissance literature. All three boys were shy at that point, but Eric began breaking through his shell. It started with occasional rumblings. Just 2 months into high school, he asked a classmate to homecoming. She remembered him as nervous and quiet, largely forgettable, until he faked his suicide a few days after the dance. "He had his friend take me over to his house," she said later. "When I went there, he was lying with his head on a rock, and there was fake blood around him, and he was acting like he was dead." It wasn't an original stunt, probably ripped off from the 1970s classic movie Harold and Maude, but it weirded her out. She refused to date him again. First semester freshman year, Eric turned in an I Am poem. His self-portrait informed the reader 5 times in 18 lines how nice he was. "I am a nice guy who hates when people open their pop can just a little," the poem began. Eric ended each stanza with that same line. He described himself flying above all the rest of us, bragged about his straight A's, and demonstrated his emotional depth. "I cry when I see or hear a dog die." He kept much of the work he produced in high school. Apparently, he was proud of it. "I dream that I am the last person on earth," he wrote in I Am. Eric was always a dreamer. But he liked them ugly, bleak, and morose, yet boring as hell. He saw beauty in the void. Eric dreamed of a world where nothing ever happened, a world where the rest of us had been removed. Eric shared his dreams in internet chat rooms. He described them vividly to online chicks. In one, he was suspended inside a small, dank room, like the interior hull of a ship. Futuristic, yet decaying old computer screens lined the walls, covered with dust and mold and vines. The moon provided the only light, trickling dimly in through the portals, shadows creeping all around. A vast sea rose and fell monotonously. Nothing happened. Eric was overjoyed. He rarely encountered humans in his creations, just the occasional combatant to extinguish or a disembodied voice to drop an ironic bon mot. Dreamland Eric had snuffed us out. He invented a world of precise textures, vivid hues, and absolutely no payoff for himself. When he did linger on the destination, it was to revel in the banality of the gloom. He described one of his dream worlds to a girl in a chat room. "Wow, kind of gloomy," she responded. "Yeah, but it's still nice, no people at all, kind of like everyone is dead and has been for centuries." Happiness for Eric was eliminating the likes of us. The girl said she could go for it, but only with some people. Eric said he'd only want a couple, and that led him to the burning question he loved to pose online. With only a few people left, would she repopulate or choose extinction? "Probably extinction," she said. "Good answer. That's what he was going for. That was the point of the entire conversation." He said. "I just wish I could actually do this instead of just dream about it." Extinction fantasies cropped up regularly and would obsess Eric in his final years. But in his online chats, there was never a sense of him intending to do the deed. He had bold dreams for the world, but more modest ideas about himself. And he was pretty convinced that we would all take care of destroying the planet without his help anyway. Zach Heckler had won class with Dylan freshman year. That was all it took. Finally, somebody understood him. Brooks and Eric were fun to hang out with, but they never really got Dylan. Not the way Kibby did. Zach did not care for that nickname, but it stuck. He was an insatiable snacker, so the kids had branded him Kibble. Great. Nicknames could be a bitch. Almost impossible to shake a wussy one. So Zach was smart about it. He quit fighting the tag and adapted it. Kibble, Kibbs, Lord Kibbs. The last one wasn't bad at all. Zach and Dylan's teacher gave him a lot of free study time. Eric would wander from the adjoining room. At first he came around to chat with Dylan, but pretty soon all three were cutting up. They played Doom, bowled, did sleepovers, went to ball games and drag races at Bandamere Speedway. They made fun of dumb kids and ignorant adults. Computer illiterates were the worst, especially when some fool put them in front of a class. The boys watched a ton of movies, lots of action and horror and science fantasy. They cruised the mall to pick up chicks. Eric did the talking. Zach and Dylan hung back and followed his lead. Dylan joined the theater group. He was too shy for the stage, but he worked lights and sound. Eric had no interest in that. They got close with Nate Dykeman and Chris Morris, too. Mostly they hung out at Dylan's. "His parents were so nice to me," Nate said. "Either they'd get donuts for me, or they'd be making crepes or omelets." Dylan also looked after his house guests, worried about whether they were having a good time. At Eric's, it was totally strict when the major got home. But until then, Eric had free rein down in the basement, where he'd set up his bedroom. They had girls over and showed off how they nailed garden crickets with BB guns. Friendships came and went, but the bond between Zach and Dylan grew stronger. They were snarky, clever, and seething with teenage anger, but way too timid to show it. Dylan and Zach needed Eric. Someone had to do the talking. Eric needed an audience. He also craved excitement. He was cool and detached, tough to rattle. Nothing seemed to faze him. Dylan was an unlit fuse. Eric led the parade. Perfect fit. They were a threesome now. Eric kept improving his Doom skills. When he got bored with the images id software provided, Eric invented his own, sketching a menagerie of heroes and villains on his notepads. He hacked into the software and created new characters, unique obstacles, higher levels, and increasingly elaborate adventures. He created muscle-bound mutants with aviator sunglass eyes and Hulk-sized demons with ox horns, claws, and fangs. Many of his warriors were decked out in medieval armor and submachine guns. One was blessed with flamethrowers for forearms. Victims were frequently on fire or freshly decapitated. Sometimes they held their own head in their hands. Eric's creations were unparalleled, in his view. In this day and age, it can be hard to find a skill that can be completely dominated and mastered, he wrote in one assignment, but I believe that I will always be the best at Doom creativity. Eric enjoyed the act of creation. I often try to create new things, he wrote in a freshman English paper titled Similarities Between Zeus and I. He hailed both of them as great leaders, finding no fault in their pettiness or malice, but identifying common inclinations. Zeus and I also get angry easily and punish people in unusual ways, he wrote. 26. Help is on the way. Dave Sanders' daughters were angry. Before they got confirmation that their dad was dead, they heard disturbing stories about his final hours. My concern is that my dad was left there, Angie Sanders told an Australian newspaper. He was still alive and not helped. The impression her family was getting was that 12 victims had been goners once the bullets left the chambers, but Dave Sanders had held on for well over 3 hours. From what Angie understood, her father could have been saved. Dave's daughters began looking into the reports, but kept their mouths shut around their mother. They had to keep the TV off when she was awake. They snatched newspapers off the doorstep and magazines out of the mailbox. They had to protect Linda. She was already a wreck. Dave Sanders was just a few feet from safety when the first shot hit him. He saw the killers, spun around, and ran for the corner, trying to save a few more students on the way there. One bullet got him in the back. It tore through his rib cage and exited through his chest. The other bullet entered through the side of his neck and came out his mouth, lacerating his tongue and shattering several teeth. The neck wound opened up one of his carotid arteries, the major blood routes to the brain. The shot to his back clipped his subclavian vein, a major vessel back to the heart. There was a lot of blood. Everyone had been guessing which way was the safest to run. Rich Long, who was head of the technology department and a good friend of Dave's, had chosen an opposite route. He first heard the shooting from the library, told students to get out, and directed a group down the main stairway right into the cafeteria, unaware that hundreds had just fled from that location. Toward the bottom of the stairs, they saw bullets flying outside the windows and reversed course. At the top of the stairs, they turned left, away from the library, and into the science wing, which also included the music rooms. They arrived just in time to see Dave get shot. Dave crashed into the lockers, then collapsed on the carpet. Rich and most of the students dove for the floor. Now Dave was really desperate. He was on his elbows trying to direct kids, one senior said. Eric and Dylan were both firing. They were lobbing pipe bombs down the length of the hall. Dave, you've got to get up, Rich yelled. We've got to get out of here. Dave pulled himself up, staggered a few feet around the corner. Rich hurried over. As soon as he was out of the line of fire, he ducked his shoulder under Dave's arm. Another teacher got Dave from the other side, and they dragged him to the science wing just a dozen feet away. Rich, they shot me in the teeth, Dave said. They moved past the first and second classrooms, then entered Science Room 3. The door opened, and Mr. Sanders comes in and starts coughing up blood, sophomore Marjorie Lindholm said. It looked like part of his jaw was missing. He just poured blood. The room was full of students. Their teacher had gone out to the hallway to investigate. When he came back, he told them to forget the test and ordered everybody up against the wall. The classroom door had a glass pane. To shooters who might be stalking through the halls, the room would appear empty if everyone huddled along the interior perimeter. That's when Dave stumbled in with two teachers assisting. He collapsed again, face first, into the front of the room. He left a couple of teeth where he landed, a freshman girl said. They got Dave into a chair. Rich, I'm not doing so well, he said. You'll be okay. I'm going to go phone for help. Several teachers had arrived, so Rich ran back out into the melee, searching for a phone. He learned that somebody was already calling for help. He went back. I need to go get you some help, Rich said. He went back into the smoky corridor and tried another lab, but the killers were getting closer, apparently right outside the lab's door this time. Rich finally took cover. Dave had several adults with him, and plenty of calls had been made about the shooting. Rich had no doubt that help was on the way. Kent Friesen, another teacher with Dave, went for immediate assistance. He ran into a nearby lab where more students were huddled. "Who knows first aid?" he asked. Aaron Hansey, a junior, and an Eagle Scout stepped up. "Come with me," Friesen said. Then all hell seemed to break loose out in the hallway. "I could feel it through the walls," Aaron said. "With each blast, I could feel the walls move." He was scared to go out there, but Friesen checked for shooters, bolted down the corridor, and Aaron followed. Aaron ran through a rapid inspection of Dave's condition, breathing steady, airway clear, skin warm, shoulder broken, gaping wounds, heavy blood loss. Aaron stripped off his own white Adidas t-shirt to stanch the flow. Other boys volunteered their shirts. He tore several into bandage strips and improvised a few tourniquets. He bundled others together into a pillow. "I've got to go. I've got to go," Dave said. He tried to stand, but failed. Teachers attended to the students. They flipped over tables to barricade the door. They opened a partition in back to an adjoining science lab, and several kids rushed to the center, farthest from the doors. The gunfire and explosions continued. A fire erupted in a nearby room, and the teacher grabbed the fire extinguisher to put it out. Screams filtered down the hall from the library. It was nothing like screams Marjorie Lindholm had heard before. Screams like, "When people are being tortured," she said. It was like they were carrying out executions, another boy in the room said. You would hear a shot, then there would be quiet, then another shot. Bam, bam, bam. The screaming and gunfire both stopped. Silence. Then more explosions, on and off and on again. The fire alarm began blaring. It was an ear-splitting pitch designed to force people out of the building through sheer pain. The teachers and students could barely hear anything over the alarm shriek, but could just make out the steady flap of helicopters outside. Someone turned on the giant TV suspended from the ceiling. They kept the volume off, but the subtitles on. It was their school, from the outside. Much of the class was transfixed at first, but their attention waned quickly. Nobody seemed to know anything. Aaron called his father, who used another line to call 911, so that paramedics could ask questions and relay instructions. Several other students and teachers called the cops. The science room group remained linked to authorities via multiple channels throughout the afternoon. Sophomore Kevin Starkey, also an Eagle Scout, assisted Aaron. "You're doing all right," the boys whispered to Dave. "They're coming. Just hold on. You can do it." They took turns applying pressure, digging their palms into his wounds. "I need help," Dave said. "I've got to get out of here." "Help is on the way," Aaron assured him. Aaron believed it was. Law enforcement was first alerted to Dave's predicament around 11:45. Dispatchers began responding that help was on the way and would arrive in about 10 minutes. The assurances were repeated for more than 3 hours, along with orders that no one leave the room under any circumstances. The 911 operator instructed the group to open the door briefly. They were to tie a red shirt around the doorknob in the hallway. The SWAT team would look for it to identify the room. There was a lot of dissent about that directive in Science Room 3. Wouldn't a red flag also attract the killers? And who was going to step out into that hallway? They decided to obey. Someone volunteered to tie the shirt to the doorknob. Around noon, teacher Doug Johnson wrote, "One bleeding to death," on the whiteboard and moved it to the window just to be sure. Occasionally, the TV coverage grabbed attention in the room. At one point, Marjorie Lindholm thought she spotted a huge mass of blood seeping out a door pictured on screen. She was mistaken. Fear had taken control. Each time Aaron and Kevin switched positions, they felt Dave's skin grow a little colder. He was losing color, taking on a bluish cast. "Where are the paramedics?" they wondered. When will the 10 minutes be up? Dave's breathing began to slow. He drifted in and out. Aaron and Kevin rolled him gently on the tile floor to keep him conscious and to keep his airway clear. He couldn't remain on his back for very long, or he would choke on his own blood. They pulled out wool safety blankets from a first aid closet and wrapped him up to keep him warm. They asked him about coaching, teaching, anything to keep him engaged and stave off shock. They slipped his wallet out and began showing him pictures. Is this your wife?
Yes.
What's your wife's name?
Linda.
He had lots of pictures, and they used them all. They talked about his daughters and his grandchildren.
These people love you, the boy said. This is why you need to live.
Aaron and Kevin grew desperate. The treatment had exceeded scouting instruction. You're trained to deal with broken arms, broken limbs, cuts and scrapes. Stuff you get on a camping trip, Aaron said. You never train for gunshot wounds. Eventually, Aaron and Kevin lost the struggle to keep Dave conscious.
I'm not going to make it, Dave said. Tell my girls I love them.
It was relatively calm for a while. The alarm kept blaring, the choppers kept thumping, and gunfire or explosions would periodically rumble through the hallways, somewhere off in the distance. Nothing had sounded particularly close for a while. Nothing seemed imminent. Dave's chest rose and fell, blood oozed out, but the boys could not rouse him. Aaron and Kevin kept trying. Some of the kids gave up on police. Around 2 p.m., they informed the 911 operator they were going to hurl a chair through the window and get Dave out themselves. She insisted they abandon the plan, which she warned them might draw the attention of the killers. At 2:38, the TV suddenly caught the room's attention again. Patrick Ireland was tumbling out the library window. Oh, my God! Some of the kids yelled. They'd hidden quietly for hours, but this was too much. Coach Sanders was not an isolated case. A kid was just as bloody just down the hall. They had assumed it was bad out there. Now they had proof. Some kids closed their eyes, pictured loved ones, and silently said goodbye. Just a few minutes later, the danger suddenly drew close again. Screams erupted from the next room. Then everything went silent for a minute. All at once, the door burst open and men in black rushed in. The killers were dressed in black. The invaders toted submachine guns. They waved them at the students, shouting fiercely, trying to outscream the fire alarm. I thought they were the gunmen, Marjorie Lindholm wrote later. I thought that now I was going to die. Some of the men turned and pointed to the huge block letters on their backs. SWAT.
Be quiet! An officer yelled. Put your hands on your heads and follow us out.
Somebody's got to stay with Mr. Sanders, someone said.
I will,
Aaron volunteered.
No, an officer said. Everyone out.
Then how about hauling Dave out with them, Kevin suggested. There were folded tables. They can improvise one as a stretcher.
No.
It seemed heartless, but the SWAT team was trained to make practical choices. Hundreds of students were trapped. The gunman could reappear any moment. The team had to assume a battlefield mentality and evacuate the maximum number in the minimum time. They could send a medic back for the injured later. The SWAT team led students single file down the stairs to the commons. They waded through 3 inches of water that had rained down from the sprinklers. Backpacks and pizza slices floated by. Don't touch them, the officers warned. Don't touch anything. A SWAT member held the door. He stopped each student, held them for 2 seconds, then tapped them on the shoulder and told them to run. That was a standard infantry maneuver. A single pipe bomb could take out an entire pack of children. A well-aimed machine gun burst could do the same, safer to space them. Outside, the kids ran past 2 dead bodies, Danny Rohrbaugh and Rachel Scott. Marjorie Lindholm remembered a weird look on their faces and a weird color to their skin. The girl just ahead of her stopped suddenly when she saw the bodies, and Marjorie caught up. A SWAT officer screamed at them to keep moving. Marjorie saw their guns trained right on her. She gave the girl a push, and they both took off. 2 SWAT officers stayed with Dave, and another called for help. It fell to a Denver SWAT member outside the building to recruit a paramedic. He spotted Troy Lamon, an EMT who had driven out from the city and was manning a triage station. Troy, I need you to go in, the SWAT officer said. Let's go. Lamon followed the officer through the flooded commons, up the stairway, past the rubble, and into Science Room 3. By that time, David stopped breathing. According to emergency triage protocol, that qualified him as dead. I knew there was nothing I could do for this guy, said Lamon, who had no equipment. But because I was stuck in a room with him by myself for 15 minutes, I wanted to help him. The SWAT officer eventually cleared Lamon to keep moving. There's nothing you can do, he said. So Lamon went on to the library. He was one of the first medics to go in. Dave Sanders' story got out fast. Both local papers, the Rocky Mountain News and the Denver Post, described his ordeal on Wednesday. On Thursday, the Rocky, as it's often called, ran a piece called Police Dispute Charges They Were Too Slow. A lot of people are angry, one student said, but the bulk of the story focused on the police response. We had 1,800 kids rushing from the school, said Jeffco Sheriff's spokesman Steve Davis. The officers had no idea which were victims and which were potential suspects. The Rocky offered this summary of the SWAT response based on the department's claims. Within 20 minutes of the first panicked call for help, a makeshift six-man SWAT team rushed into the sprawling school, and within an hour, dozens of heavily armed officers in body armor launched a methodical, room-by-room search of the building. The department would eventually admit that it took more than twice that long, 47 minutes, for the first five-man team to enter. The other half of that team attended to wounded students on the lawn, but never proceeded in. A second team entered after nearly 2 hours, until the killers' bodies were found. That was it. The situation grew hotter on Friday when a veteran suburban cop laid down 13 roses in Clement Park and then described the SWAT response as pathetic. It pissed me off, he told reporters. I'd have someone in there. We were trained to do that. We are trained to go in there. The officer's statement was widely reported. He became an instant symbol, and his department foolishly extended the story by placing him on non-disciplinary leave and ordering a fitness-for-duty evaluation. They backpedaled a few days later. Members of the SWAT teams began responding in the press. It was just a nightmare, said a sergeant. What parents need to understand is we wanted teams in there as quickly as we could. We were going into the situation blind. We had multiple explosions going off. We thought there could have been a band of terrorists in there. Officers were nearly as confused as TV viewers. Outside, they could hear the blasts, but once they entered, they couldn't even hear one another. The fire alarm drowned out everything. Communication was limited to hand signals. Had we heard gunfire and screaming, we would have gone right to that, a SWAT officer explained. The barrage of noise and strobe lights beat down their psyches like psychological warfare. Officers could not locate anyone with the alarm code to shut it down. They found an assistant principal, but she was so frazzled she couldn't remember the digits. In desperation, officers tried to beat the alarm speakers off the walls. One tried to disable the control panel by smashing the glass cover with his rifle butt. The alarms and sprinklers continued until 4:04 p.m. The strobe light that flashed with the alarm continued for weeks. Those were legitimate obstacles, the Sanders family acknowledged. But more than 3 hours after he was shot, Linda's sister, Melody, was designated family spokesperson. Some of his daughters are angry, she told the New York Times a few days later. They feel like, had they gone in and gotten Dave out sooner, he would have lived. Melody said the Sanders family didn't hold the SWAT members responsible, but the system was a disaster. It was utter chaos, Melody said. The family expressed gratitude for the efforts that had been made. As a gesture of goodwill, they invited the full SWAT teams to Dave's funeral. All the officers attended. 27. Black. Eric was evolving inside. Sophomore year, the changes began to show. For his first 15 years, Eric had concentrated on assimilation. Dylan had sought the same goal, with less success. Despite the upheavals of moving, Eric always made friends. Social status was important. They were just like everybody else, a classmate said later. Eric's neighbor described him as nice, polite, preppy, and a dork. High school was full of dorks. Eric could live with that for a while. Sophomore year, he tried an edgier look, combat boots, all-black outfits, and grunge. He started shopping at a trendy shop called Hot Topic and the Army Surplus Store. He liked the look. He liked the feeling. Their buddy Chris Morris began sporting a beret. That was a little much, Eric thought. He wanted to look different, not retarded. Eric was breaking out of his shell. He grew boisterous, moody, and aggressive. Sometimes he was playful, speaking in funny voices and flirting with girls. He had a lot of ideas, and he began expressing them with confidence. Dylan never did. Most of the girls who knew Eric described him as cute. He was aware of the consensus, but didn't quite accept it. He responded candidly to one of those chain email questionnaires asking for likes, dislikes, and personal attributes. Under looks, he wrote, 5'10", 140, skinny, but handsome, some say. The one thing he would like to change about himself was his weight. Such a freaking runt. He'd always hated his appearance. Now, at least he had a look. Eric took some flack for the new getup. Older kids and bigger guys razzed him sometimes, but nothing exceptional. And he was talking back now and provoking confrontations. He'd shaken off his silence, along with the preppy uniform. Dylan remained quiet right up until the end. He wasn't much for mouthing off, except in rare sudden bursts that freaked everyone out a little. He followed Eric's fashion lead, but a less intense version, so he took a lot less ribbing. Eric could have silenced the taunts any time by conforming again, but by this point, he got a kick out of standing out. The impression I always got from them was they kind of wanted to be outcasts, another classmate said. It wasn't that they were labeled that way. It's what they chose to be. Outcast was a matter of perception. Kids who slapped that label on Eric and Dylan meant the boys rejected the preppy model, but so did hundreds of other kids at the school. Eric and Dylan had very active social calendars and far more friends than the average adolescent. They fit in with a whole thriving subculture. Their friends respected one another and ridiculed the conformity of the vanilla wafers looking down on them. They had no desire to emulate the jocks. Could there be a faster route to boredom? For Dylan, different was difficult. For Eric, different was good. For Halloween that year, Eric Dutroux, a junior, wanted to go as Dracula. He needed a cool coat, something dramatic. He had a flair for theatrics. So his parents picked up a long black duster at Sam's Club. The kids referred to this as a trench coat. The costume didn't work out, but the trench coat was cool. Eric Dutroux hung on to it. He started wearing it to school. It made quite an impression. The trench coat turned a whole lot of heads, and Dutroux loved turning heads. He had a hard time at school. Kids at Columbine picked on him. Kids would ridicule him relentlessly, calling him a freak and a faggot. Eventually, he fought back the only way he knew how, by upping the ante. If they were going to call him freak, he was going to give them one hell of a freak show. The trench coat made a nice little addition to his freak drobe. Not surprisingly, Dutroux hung with a bunch of kids who liked turning heads, too. After a while, several of them were sporting trench coats. They would dress all in black and wear the long coats even in the summer. Somewhere along the line, someone referred to them as the Trench Coat Mafia, TCM for short. It stuck. Eric Dutroux, Chris Morris, and a handful of other boys were pretty much the core of the TCM, but a dozen more were often associated with the TCM as well, whether they sported trench coats or not. Eric and Dylan were not among them. Each of them knew some of the TCM kids, and Eric especially, would become buddies with Chris. That was as close as they came. Eventually, after the TCM heyday was over, Eric got himself a trench coat. Dylan followed. They wore them to the massacre for both fashion and functional considerations. The choice would cause tremendous confusion. 28. Media crime. The trench coat mafia was mythologized because it was colorful, memorable, and fit the existing myth of the school shooter as outcast loner. All the Columbine myths worked that way, and they all sprang to life incredibly fast. Most of the notorious myths took root before the killers' bodies were found. We remember Columbine as a pair of outcast goths from the Trenchcoat Mafia, snapping and tearing through their high school, hunting down jocks to settle a long-running feud. Almost none of that happened. No goths, no outcasts, nobody snapping, no targets, no feud, and no Trenchcoat Mafia. Most of those elements existed at Columbine, which is what gave them such currency. They just had nothing to do with the murders. The lesser myths are equally unsupported. No connection to Marilyn Manson, Hitler's birthday, minorities, or Christians. Few people knowledgeable about the case believe those myths anymore. Not reporters, investigators, families of the victims, or their legal teams. And yet, most of the public takes them for granted. Why? Media defenders blame the chaos. 2,000 witnesses, wildly conflicting reports, who could get all those facts straight? But facts were not the problem, nor did time sort them out. The first print story arrived in an extra edition of the Rocky Mountain News. It went to press at 3 o'clock on Tuesday afternoon, before the bodies in the library were found. The Rockies' 900-word summary of the massacre was an extraordinary piece of journalism, gripping, empathetic, and astonishingly accurate. It nailed the details and the big picture, two ruthless killers picking off students indiscriminately. It was the first story published that spring to get the essence of the attack right, and one of the last. It is an axiom of journalism that disaster stories begin in confusion and grow clearer over time. Facts rush in, the fog lifts, an accurate picture solidifies. The public accepts this. But the final portrait is often furthest from the truth. 1 hour into the Columbine horror, news stations were informing the public that two or more gunmen were behind it. 2 hours in, the Trenchcoat Mafia were to blame. The TCM were portrayed as a cult of homosexual goths in makeup, orchestrating a bizarre death pact for the year 2000. Ludicrous or not, the TCM myth was the most defensible of the big media blunders. The killers did wear trench coats. A small group had named themselves after the garment a year earlier. A few kids put the two together, and it's hard to blame them. It seemed like a tidy fit. But the crucial detail, unreported Tuesday afternoon, was that most kids in Clement Park were not citing the TCM. Few were even naming Eric and Dylan. In a school of 2,000, most of the student body didn't even know the boys. Nor had many seen gunfire directly. Initially, most students told reporters they had no idea who attacked them. That changed fast. Most of the 2,000 got themselves to a television or kept a constant cell phone vigil with viewers. It took only a few TV mentions for the Trenchcoat connection to take hold. It sounded so obvious. Of course, Trenchcoats, Trenchcoat Mafia. TV journalists were actually careful. They used attribution and disclaimers like believed to be or described as. Some wondered out loud about the killers' identities and then described the TCM, leaving viewers to draw the link. Repetition was the problem. Only a handful of students mentioned the TCM during the first 5 hours of CNN coverage, virtually all fed from local news stations. But reporters homed in on the idea. They were responsible about how they addressed the rumors, but blind to the impact of how often. Kids knew the TCM was involved because witnesses and news anchors had said so on TV. They confirmed it with friends watching similar reports. Word spread fast. Conversation was the only teen activity in South Jeffco Tuesday afternoon. Pretty soon, most of the students had multiple independent confirmations. They believed they knew the TCM was behind the attack as a fact. From 1 to 8 p.m., the number of students in Clement Park citing the group went from almost none to nearly all. They weren't making it up. They were repeating it back. The second problem was a failure to question. In those first 5 hours, not a single person on the CNN feeds asked a student how they knew the killers were part of the trench coat mafia. Print reporters, talk show hosts, and the rest of the media chain repeated those mistakes. All over town, the ominous new phrase, trench coat mafia, was on everyone's lips. USA Today reported Wednesday morning. That was a fact. But who was telling whom? The writers assumed kids were informing the media. It was the other way around. Most of the myths were in place by nightfall. By then, it was a given that the killers had been targeting jocks. The target myth was the most insidious because it went straight to motive. The public believes Columbine was an act of retribution, a desperate reprisal for unspeakable jock abuse. Like the other myths, it began with a kernel of truth. In the first few hours, a shattered junior named Bree Pasquale became the marquee witness of the tragedy. She had escaped unharmed, but splattered in blood. Bree described the library horror in convincing detail. Radio and television stations replayed her testimony relentlessly. "They were shooting anyone of color, wearing a white hat or playing a sport," she said. "And they didn't care who it was, and it was all at close range. Everyone around me got shot, and I begged him for 10 minutes not to shoot me." The problem with Bree Pasquale's account is the contradiction between facts and conclusion. That's typical of witnesses under extreme duress. If the killers were shooting everyone, didn't that include jocks, minorities, and hat wearers? 4 times in that brief statement, she described random killing, yet reporters glommed on to the anomaly in her statement. Bullying and racism? Those were known threats. Explaining it away was reassuring. By evening, the target theory was dominating most broadcasts. Nearly all the major papers featured it. The Rocky and the Washington Post refused to embrace the targeting theory all week, but they were lonely dissenters. Initially, most witnesses refuted the emerging consensus. Nearly all described the killing as random. All the papers in the wire services produced a total of just 4 witnesses advancing the target theory Wednesday morning, each one contradicting his or her own description. Most of the papers advanced the theory with just 1 student who had actually seen it. Some had 0. Reuters attributed the theory to many witnesses and USA Today to students. Student equaled witness. Witness to everything that happened that day and anything about the killers. It was a curious leap. Reporters would not make that mistake at a car wreck. Did you see it? If not, they move on. But journalists felt like foreigners stepping into teen culture. They knew kids can hide anything from adults, but not from each other. That was the mentality. Something shocking happened here. We're baffled. But kids know. So all 2,000 were deputized as insiders. If students said targeting, that was surely it. Police detectives rejected the universal witness concept, and they relied on traumatized witnesses for observations, not conclusions. They never saw targeting as plausible. They were baffled by the media consensus. Journalists were not relying exclusively on students. The entire industry was depending on the Denver Post. The paper sent 54 reporters, 8 photographers, and 5 artists into the field. They had the most resources and the best contacts. Day 1, they were hours ahead of the national pack. The first week, they were a day ahead on most developments. The Rocky Mountain News had a presence as well, but they had a smaller staff, and the national press trusted the Post. It did not single-handedly create any of the myths, but as the Post bought into one after another, each mistaken conclusion felt safe. The pack followed. The Jeffco Parks and Recreation District began hauling truckloads of hay bales into Clement Park. It was a mess. Thousands of people gathered at the northeast corner of the park on Wednesday, and tens of thousands appeared on Thursday and Friday. The snow had begun fluttering down Wednesday, and the foot traffic tore the field to shreds. By Thursday, it was an enormous mud pit. Nobody seemed to care much, but county workers scattered thick layers of hay in winding paths all along the makeshift memorials. They didn't know it yet. They had no idea there was a name for it, but many of the survivors had entered the early stages of post-traumatic stress disorder. Many had not. It wasn't a matter of how close they had been to witnessing or experiencing the violence. Length and severity of exposure increased their odds of mental health trouble down the road, but long-term responses were highly varied, depending on each individual. Some kids who had been in the library during the shootings would turn out fine, while others who had been off to Wendy's would be traumatized for years. Dr. Frank Ochberg, a professor in psychiatry at Michigan State University and a leading expert on PTSD, would be brought in by the FBI a few months later and would spend years advising mental health workers on the case. He and a group of psychiatrists had first developed the term in the 1970s. They had observed a phenomenon that was stress-induced but was qualitatively more severe and brought on by a really traumatic experience. This was something that produced truly profound effects and lasted for years or, if untreated, even a lifetime. A far milder and more common response was also underway, survivor's guilt. It began playing out almost immediately in the hallways of the 6 local hospitals where the injured were recovering. At St. Anthony's, the first week, the waiting rooms were packed with students coming to see Patrick Ireland. Every seat in every room was taken. Dozens of students waited in the hallways. Patrick spent the first days in ICU. Most visitors were refused, but the kids kept streaming into the hospital room anyway. They just needed to be there. "You have to realize that this was part of their healing, too," Kathy Ireland said. All day, some of them stayed, and well into the evening. The staff started bringing food in once they realized some of the kids hadn't been eating. Patrick's situation looked grim. His doctors were just hoping to keep him alive. They advised John and Kathy to keep expectations low. Whatever condition they observed the first day or two would be the prognosis for the rest of his life. John and Kathy accepted this, and they saw a paralyzed boy struggling mightily to speak gibberish. The medical staff chose to not operate on Patrick's broken right foot. They cleaned out the wound and placed a brace around it. "Why?" his parents asked. There were more pressing concerns, they were told, and Patrick was never going to use that foot. John and Kathy were devastated, but they had to be realists. They turned their attention to raising an invalid and figuring out how to help him be happy that way. Patrick was unaware of the prognosis. It never occurred to him that he might not walk. He viewed the injury like a broken bone. You wear a cast, you build the muscle back, you pick your life up where you left off. He knew it would be tougher than the time he broke his thumb. A lot tougher. It might take 3 or 4 times as long to recover. He assumed he would recover. Patrick's friend, Mackay, was released from St. Anthony's Friday. He had been shot in the knee alongside Patrick. Reporters were invited into the hospital library for a press conference broadcast on CNN. Mackay was in a wheelchair. It turned out that he'd known Dylan. "I thought he was an all right guy," Mackay said. "Decent, real smart." They'd taken the same French class and worked together on school projects. "He was a nice guy. Never treated me bad," Mackay said. "He wasn't the kind of person he's being portrayed as." Patrick made improvement with his speech the first week, and his vitals began returning to normal. On Friday, he was moved out of the ICU and into a regular room. Once he had settled in, his parents decided it was time to ask him the burning question. Had he gone out the library window? They knew. They just had to know if he did. Did he know why he was there? Was the trauma of the truth still ahead? "Well, yeah," he stammered. "Were they just figuring that out?" "He was incredulous," Kathy said later. "He looked at us like, 'How could you be so ignorant?'" She was okay with that. All she felt was relief. That same week, Dr. Alan Weintraub, a neurologist from Craig Hospital, came to see Patrick. Craig is one of the leading rehab centers in the world, specializing in brain and spinal cord injuries. It's located in Jeffco, not far from the Ireland's home. Dr. Weintraub examined Patrick, reviewed his charts, and gave John and Kathy his assessment. "The first thing I can say to you is there's hope." They were astounded, relieved, and perplexed. Later, the discrepancy made sense to them. The staffs had different expertise and different perspectives. St. Anthony specialized in trauma. "Their goal is to save lives," Kathy said. "At Craig, the goal is to rebuild them." They began making arrangements to transfer Patrick to Craig. By Thursday, students in Clement Park were angry. The killers were dead. So much of the anger was deflected onto goths, Marilyn Manson, the TCM, or anyone who looked, dressed, or acted like the killers, or the media's portrayal of them. The killers were quickly cast as outcasts and fags. "They're freaks," said an angry sophomore from the soccer team. "Nobody really liked them, just 'cause they..." He paused, then plunged ahead. "The majority of them were gay, so everyone would make fun of them." Several jocks reported having seen the killers and friends touching in the hallways, groping each other, or holding hands. A football player captivated reporters with tales of group showering. The gay rumor was almost invisible in the media, but rampant in Clement Park. The stories were vague. Everything was third hand. None of the storytellers even knew the killers. Everyone in Clement Park heard the rumors. Most of the students saw through them. They were disgusted at the jocks for defaming the killers the same way in death as they had in life. Clearly, "gay" was one of the worst epithets one kid could hurl against another in Jeffco. Eric and Dylan's friends generally shrugged off the stories. One of them was outraged. "The media's taken my friends and made them to be gay and neo-Nazis and all these hater stuff," he said. "They're portraying my friends as idiots." The angry boy was a brawny, 6-foot senior dressed in camouflage pants. He ranted for several hours, and he was soon all over the national press, sometimes looking a bit ridiculous. He stopped talking. His father began screening media calls. A few papers mentioned the gay rumors in passing. Reverend Jerry Falwell described the killers as gay on Rivera Live. A notorious picketer of gay funerals issued a media alert saying, "Two filthy fags slaughtered 13 people at Columbine High." Most significantly, the Drudge Report quoted internet postings claiming that the Trenchcoat Mafia was a gay conspiracy to kill jocks. But most major media carefully sidestepped the gay rumor. The press failed to show similar deference to goths. Some of the most withering attacks were reserved for that group, a morose acting subculture best known for powder white face paint and black clothes, black lips, and black fingernails accented by heavy, dripping mascara. They were mistakenly associated with the killers on Tuesday by students unfamiliar with the goth concept. Equally clueless reporters amplified the rumor. One of the most egregious reports was an extended 2020 segment ABC aired just one night after the attack. Diane Sawyer introduced it by noting that unnamed police said, "The boys may have been part of a dark, underground national phenomenon known as the Gothic Movement, and that some of these goths may have killed before." It was true, goths had killed before, as had members of every conceivable background and subculture. Correspondent Brian Ross described a double murder committed by goths and two ghastly attempts in graphic detail. He presented them as evidence of a pattern, a goth crime wave poised to sweep through suburbia and threaten us all. The so-called Gothic movement has helped fuel a new kind of teenage gang, white suburban gangs built around a fascination with the grotesque and with death, he said. He played other examples, as well as a horrifying 911 tape of a victim calling for help with a knife still protruding from his chest. "Hurry," he pleaded. "I'm not going to last too much longer." Ross described the killers in that case as proud, self-proclaimed members of the Gothic movement, and like the students involved in yesterday's shootings, focused on white extremism and hate. The only real problem with Ross's report were that goths tended to be meek and pacifist. They had never been associated with violence, much less murder. And aside from long black coats, they had almost nothing in common with Eric and Dylan. Where it avoided snap conclusions, much of the reporting was first rate. The Rocky passed on most of the myths, and it, the Post, and the Times ran excellent bios on the killers. On TV, several correspondents helped survivors convey their stories with empathy, dignity, and insight. Katie Couric was a particular standout, and several papers tried to rein in the goth scare,